radio. Freak radio. Freak radio. Freak radio. Freak radio. Freak radio. Freak radio. 96.3. Freak radio. Freak radio. Freak radio. Freak radio. Freak radio. Freak radio.
From the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, it's time for the weekly Freak Show. Headlines and highlights for the week ending Thursday, June 7th, 2001. My name's the V-Man, and I'll be your host for this half-hour look back at the news and features not heard in or glanced over by the corporate-controlled media. On this week's program, I'll be speaking with Peter Frank of the National Lawyers Guild, Center for Democratic Communications, in a special live phone interview about the latest on the FCC plan to license low-power FM radio stations. Plus, this week's Spotlight Sound. Stand by for the weekly Freak Show coming up next. Now, headlines for the week ending Thursday, June 7th, 2001. A group of 12 students and three union members were arrested on Friday, June 1st, after a march in support of janitors' rights at UC San Diego. Protesters are demanding the school allow janitors to unionize if they choose, offer health benefits and sick days, and pay a living wage of $11.24 an hour. Janitors at the school currently receive $6.25 an hour and are not permitted to organize a union. After the rally, a crowd of over 100 marched through the town of La Jolla. 15 were arrested after blocking traffic on a main intersection in the center of town. Nearly 50 people gathered in Seattle's Central District on Friday, June 1st, a day after Seattle police officer Greg Price shot and killed unarmed black motorist Aaron Roberts with a single bullet. Roberts, who had recently skipped out on a prison work release program, was reportedly driving erratically and attempted to flee as another officer, Greg Newbert, was pulled alongside his car. Price shot Roberts at close range after entering his car. The 50 people gathered Friday were quickly outnumbered by a contingent of riot police and more cops circling on horseback. The protesters did succeed in stopping a semi-truck midway through the intersection where the killing occurred, thus completely blocking midday traffic for 3 hours. A larger peaceful march took place in the city on Wednesday, June 6th, and meetings continue with the People's Coalition for Justice, who want city officials to address demands for a civilian review board overseeing police and for effective policies to eliminate racial profiling. Meanwhile, about 2,000 people took to the streets in Cincinnati, Ohio, on Saturday, June 2nd, to protest the killing of Timothy Thomas, an unarmed 19-year-old black man shot on April 7th by Cincinnati police officer Steve Roach. The killing sparked a week of unrest in the city that prompted officials to impose a citywide curfew and a state of emergency. In May, a grand jury indicted the officer on misdemeanor charges of negligent homicide and obstructing official business for the killing. Both the charges filed against Roach are punishable by a total maximum of 9 months in jail. Saturday's peaceful protest in Cincinnati turned ugly when police moved in on a group of about 100 activists who broke away from the larger March for Justice to block an intersection in the upscale Mount Adams neighborhood. After police ordered people onto the sidewalks, they charged in and made 12 arrests. People were following police orders and weren't doing civil disobedience when the arrests took place, one protester said. The 12 activists were charged with misdemeanor counts of disorderly conduct and resisting arrest and have since been released on bond. A string of vandalism incidents to hit Santa Cruz this week has left city officials scratching their heads. In the early morning hours of Monday, June 4th, someone shattered a window at City Hall and ran a hose into a conference room, leaving at least an inch of water on the carpet. Two nearby law offices and an insurance firm reported similar incidents. Then, at approximately 3 a.m. on Wednesday, June 6th, three men wearing hooded sweatshirts were spotted as they each threw one rock at the Gap clothing store on Pacific Avenue. The suspects fled the scene in a compact car. When police arrived, they found three rocks near a cracked window and reported nothing stolen from the store. Another incident occurred in the early hours of Thursday, June 7th, at the State Parks Office in Santa Cruz, where vandals caused an estimated $100,000 in damage when someone wedged a hose through a door crack on the second floor. The water was turned on full blast, and by 8 a.m., a waterfall was dribbling from the top floor of the two-story building through the first floor and into the basement parking lot. Computers, fax machines, and other valuables were destroyed. Building owner Bruce Dunn said, quote, "The water got all down into the electrical room, got in the elevator mechanism. They're going to be out of the building for a month at least." In each incident, the vandals brought their own garden hoses and hooked them to outdoor water spigots. Santa Cruz police have not arrested anyone in connection with these incidents and have not identified any suspects. And finally, in the early morning hours of Thursday, June 7th, police in Copenhagen, Denmark, raided a warehouse being used by activists preparing for the June 14th summit of the European Union in Gothenburg, Sweden. The building was reportedly damaged in the pre-dawn raid, and police confiscated and destroyed a majority of protest materials. Also Thursday, protest organizers received a letter from Swedish National Police Director Sten Heckscher, who writes that police have no plans to refuse foreign activists from entering into Sweden for to attend activities in Gothenburg during the EU top meeting. A special request for police to refuse entrance must be made in advance, and Heckscher denies that such a request had been placed. However, authorities may still refuse entrance to individuals in cases of extraordinary circumstances. And those were headlines for the week ending Thursday, June 7th, 2001. Peter Frank has been working with the National Lawyers Guild Center on Democratic Communications since it began in 1987. Founded in 1937 as the first racially integrated National Progressive Bar Association, the National Lawyers Guild has worked to serve as the legal arm of the People's Movement in the U.S. The work of the Committee on Democratic Communications focuses on the right of all people to a system of media and communications based upon the principle of cultural and informational self-determination. The CDC supports independent media organizations and forms of communication, such as micro radio, public access TV, and cyberspace resources, and works to ensure that they can function free from government or big business control. The committee offers legal advice and representation to groups and individuals seeking to establish and sustain such forms of communication. Spurned by a vibrant movement by citizens taking to the airwaves in defiance of federal law, on January 20, 2000, the Federal Communications Commission established a plan to offer licenses for citizens to operate low-powered FM radio stations. When it created the LPFM service, the FCC stated that its goals were to create opportunities for new voices on the airwaves and to allow local groups, including schools, churches, and other community-based organizations, to provide programming responsive to local community needs and interests. Opposition to LPFM was mounted by the National Association of Broadcasters and National Public Radio. In December, an act of Congress severely curtailed the scope of the FCC plan. In recent weeks, the FCC has slowly started to hand out construction permits for LPFM operations. Now, for a discussion on the FCC's slow rollout of the low-power FM radio plan, I'm happy to be joined by Peter Frank. Peter, I want to welcome you to the program.
And thanks for having me on your pioneering airwaves.
Peter, I'd like to start with a bit of a background on this LPFM plan. Tell our listeners how this LPFM plan came before the FCC and exactly what this newly established radio service would look like.
Well, let me start with the end because it's simpler. The newly established radio service, the FCC will license, right now they're in the process of licensing 100-watt stations. A full-power station like KPFA in Berkeley is 59,000 watts. A 100-watt station, depending on where its antenna is, has got a range of about 10 to 15 miles. It's really community radio, literally. It's local radio, it's city radio. It's designed to serve local communities, and it's very cheap and economical to set up and to run. There used to be 10-watt stations, which were college stations. They were called Class D stations. 25 years ago, under pressure from the public broadcasting establishment, Corporation for Public Broadcasting and National Public Radio, the Federal Communications Commission stopped licensing those stations and squeezed them out. This was part of an attempt by NPR to have fewer and bigger radio stations in the public system. Starting about 12 or 13 years ago, people started going on the air with very low-powered, cheap radio. The pioneer was Mabana Kantako, an unemployed, blind, black man living in a housing project in southern Illinois, who got a little kit and with 1 watt of power had a 3-mile radius and was really speaking to the entire black community of Springfield, which is a pretty conservative area. From that beginning, things grew. We had some initial legal victories in protecting the microstations, and really as acts of civil disobedience and acts of necessity, just as your station is, people went on the air. At the peak, I think there was about 1,000 low-power stations on the air. The Federal Communications Commission was faced with a classic case of civil disobedience and was in the position of, if you can't beat them, join them. Also, I think out of the sincere concern of Bill Kennard, who was first minority chairperson of the FCC, about diversity and the concentration effects of the 1996 Telecommunications Act, they started a 2.5-year rulemaking proceeding, very cautious, very slow, but ultimately they agreed to license these 100-watt stations. They're going to, in addition, come back around later, and if there's any room in the spectrum, license even smaller stations, 10-watt stations, which probably have a range of about 1 to 2 miles. So that's sort of the basic situation in a nutshell, except the Congress got in the act late in the middle of the night, literally late December, and passed a law partially overruling the FCC, cutting back the number of stations that there's going to be.
Now, how would the new service that the FCC wanted to create before Congress got involved, how would that affect existing full-power radio stations?
Well, it wouldn't. The FCC was very cautious. Well, first of all, the National Association of Broadcasters claimed there'd be interference all over the map. But in fact, we commissioned a study, and the FCC did a study. There were some other studies which made it clear that under their plan, there would be no interference. In fact, the FCC mandated greater channel separation than the engineering shows is necessary because they were being cautious and trying unsuccessfully to keep Congress off their back. So it's, it's David and Goliath. You put a 100-watt station next to a 60,000-watt station, and you're not going to have interference. And the 60,000-watt station has what's called a protected contour. It's out to a certain distance with the big station. Out to a certain distance, nobody's allowed to interfere, and that's not changed by LPFM. These stations will be slotted in where there's frequency space, which means even under the FCC's plan, in major metropolitan areas, there were hardly any frequencies. The other thing I should note quickly, and I hope we can come back to this, is that the FCC has been accepting applications for these licenses in what's called filing windows.
Right.
A 5-day period in which anybody who wants to apply in a given group of states has to get their application in. The final filing window, which is for 20 states and 2 territories, is next week, Monday through Friday, and everyone has to get their application in. So if there's anyone hearing this who's thinking about applying, they should go to our webpage. I'll give that in a few minutes. Assistance is available in doing this, but there's a lot to do, and people have to hustle if they're still interested in getting these licenses.
Now, what groups would be eligible to receive one of these licenses, and how is the FCC going to choose among the qualified applicants who to give a license to?
Qualification is any local nonprofit organization. It doesn't have to be a nonprofit corporation, doesn't have to have nonprofit status from the IRS, but it has to be established under nonprofit principles. And it has to be locally owned and controlled, and there's some technical requirements by which they enforce that. Where people compete, where they're applying for the same frequency, the FCC has set up a point system. It's supposed to be a pretty mechanical process. You get a certain number of points for having been around for a while, and there's some other point aspects. And who gets the most points gets the license, except that groups are allowed to combine their points. They're encouraging competing applicants to come together and make a deal to share the frequencies.
Now, in the FCC's initial rulemaking in January 2000, part of it was excluding pirates from being eligible for applications for low-power FM. anybody that was on the air after February of 1999, or anybody who didn't shut down within a 24-hour period of being notified by the FCC that they were in violation of their laws, would be considered ineligible. And as you mentioned earlier, in December last year, December 2000, Congress passed the Radio Preservation Act, basically limiting the number of stations in the FCC plan, scaling back their plan. Another aspect of the Congressional Act also strengthened the anti-pirate quotation in the original plan. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Yes. Of course, I think the pirates are NBC and CBS, and those corporations are still on the people's airwaves. I think what we're talking about with stations like you is unlicensed broadcasters. But whatever language you want to use, the Congressional Act, and I should emphasize, it was a rider placed on one of the three humongous appropriations bills that had to go through Congress in the waning days of the Clinton administration. If it didn't, there would have been another government shutdown. There was no hearings, no nothing. It was really snuck through. It said that no station can apply for a license that's been an unlicensed broadcaster, and no organization can apply for a license if a member of its board or somebody in a controlling position with it was ever an unlicensed broadcaster. Doesn't mean that somebody who has been an unlicensed broadcaster couldn't have a show once the station gets on the air, but they couldn't be on the board.
I see. Okay.
And coming up on another deadline on that, there were 22 applications filed in the first two filing windows that were former pirates or unlicensed broadcasters, as you say, but qualified under the old FCC rule of you got to get off the air when you're told to. They have until next Monday to amend their applications in a way that would still get them the licenses, and they should go to our webpage and read about that if anybody in that situation is listening.
Okay. What's your website?
It's www.nlgcdc.org. Stands for National Lawyers Guild Center on Democratic Communications, nlgcdc.org.
And we're speaking with Peter Frank in a special live interview. We're going to take a brief musical break and be back with Peter in just a moment. Please stay tuned to the Weekly Freak Show. You're tuned to BLR 104.1 FM in Berkeley, California. Turning to Peter Frank, who's on the line. Peter, we were just talking a moment ago about the Congressional Radio Preservation Act of 2000, which restricts the FCC from implementing their LPFM plan. since that time, Arizona Senator John McCain has introduced legislation which would essentially reverse that action. How has that bill been moving through the floors of the Senate, and has it picked up any sponsors?
Well, it hasn't been moving. He also had put in a bill before to try and block the Radio Preservation Act. He's actually been one of our strong supporters in Congress, which is interesting. So far as I know, it hasn't really moved. There may be one or two co-sponsors. I don't think anybody's really pushed it. Everybody's been waiting to see how the whole political situation shakes out. And with the change in leadership in the Senate, the chairmanship of the Congress, of the Commerce Committee, which is the one that has jurisdiction, which was McCain, now switches to Hollings. And Hollings has not been any friend of Low Power FM. However, the act did require the FCC to do some more studies. And once they do those studies, which I suspect will be in about 9 months, they've got to revisit everybody has to revisit the issue. So we anticipate building up a head of steam and trying to get this reversed. One thing which is a mixed blessing from my point of view, blessing is sort of a pun, is that a lot of the frequencies have been taken up by very conservative-sounding religious groups, which is not really the constituency that we had in mind in fighting for this over the years. But it does create a constituency of considerable power that has an interest in LPFM. So we're in some hopes that we can expand this. The other thing to say is that while Congress thought it was cutting back the number of licenses by about 80%, turns out that I don't know if they did their engineering wrong, but they've cut out about 50% of the available frequencies. So there is a fair amount of licensing still going on.
Okay. And they've actually recently, as I guess about probably mid-April of this year, started issuing the first of those construction permits for low-power FM. Do you feel that the FCC has met their challenge, their mandate to open up the airwaves for, you know, marginalized people?
Well, I think that, how do I answer? Yeah, I think that they have tried. You know, they were too cautious in allocating spectrum space, and they've moved, well, right now, since the election, they've been moving rather slowly, but there's been almost 100% turnover in the composition of the FCC. People may not know that the new chair of the FCC is Michael Powell, whose father is Colin Powell, who people may have heard of in connection with war. Or
Defense Secretary.
Yeah. I would say, frankly, the staff has been fairly sympathetic to LPFM. And at other times, they've moved as fast as they could. It's a complicated thing, and the National Association of Broadcasters is waiting in the wings to go to court to stop them if they violated any rights by going too fast. In fact, the NAB did try that, but so far they haven't been successful.
Well, Michael Powell, as you mentioned, is now the chairman of the FCC. He takes over for Kennard, who resigned shortly before Bush took over. He recently spoke at the NAB convention in Las Vegas in April 2001, and as chairman, it was at the chairman's breakfast. He stated, under his leadership, the FCC is, quote, unlikely to launch an LPFM program. We are just going to follow through on what we've been told to do. We'll see where we end up. What would your response be to these statements by the chairman?
Well, you know, there's a little bit of hypocrisy going on here. He came in and he made, at that conference and a lot of other places, lots of comments about the government should get out of the way and about deregulating radio and broadcasting generally. But in this area, in the area of free speech for the little people, so to speak, the grassroots people, suddenly he wants to do more regulation to keep people off the airwaves. What that just shows is that even though he and others complained about LPFM as causing an appearance and so on, that everybody is afraid of the free speech, the grassroots content that's not filtered by the minions of General Electric and NBC.
In the meantime, we've been talking a little bit earlier in the first segment about the rollout of the FCC's plan, and we've touched upon that a little bit here. The window, as you mentioned, is going to be open Monday, June 11th.
Right.
That's the final filing window that was combined for the 22 states and territories. This is the last opportunity for quite some time to apply for one of these licenses. What is the National Lawyers Guild's Committee on Democratic Communications doing to help people through this very murky process?
Well, on our webpage are most of the forms necessary and a number of explanatory booklets and links to other explanatory material. We also have working relationships with several broadcast engineers who are skilled at finding if there are frequencies under the LPFM rules, and we're trying to help people through the process as much as we can. In one case, we're helping somebody do an application which we know is going to be turned down, but we're setting up a test case to challenge this new law. People should go to our webpage, which again is nlgcdc.org.
nlgcdc.org.
Yes. Or they can send email to us at lpfm_info@nlg.org, and tell us where they're at, what questions they have, and they should put a phone number in there, because some of this has to be done by the old-fashioned telephone. And we'll do as much as we can to help them through the process. They do have to, one of the things that's made it difficult is that they have to apply online at the FCC's webpage.
Right.
To help with that process. The process looks difficult, but it can be dealt with, but the time is short. The filing window is this Monday through Friday, June 15th, and that's a drop-dead deadline. If the application isn't in by then, it's too late. Now, there is some talk that sometime later, maybe in the late summer, early fall, the FCC may, and this has not been firmly decided, open one more filing window for any frequencies that are already not gone. So if you're out in the middle of the desert in Arizona and want to wait that chance, and this may pick up some frequencies elsewhere, California was in the first window, so those have already closed. So there may be a chance later for people who are not in this first window. Do we have time for me to read the states that are in this current window?
Well, I'd actually like to, we're kind of running short on time, and I'd like to ask you one question before we do move on here. How does all this affect the vibrant unlicensed movement that created this whole thing, this whole LPFM? Where do the pirates, the unlicensed broadcasters, the pioneers, people like ourselves who are ineligible, where do we stand through all this, in terms of licensing?
First of all, we regard it as unfair and a violation of rights. It's like saying that the students who sat in for civil rights in the 60s at lunch counters were the only ones not allowed to sit at the lunch counter once it was integrated. The FCC, it's not legal. We think there are some legal defenses. The FCC may start to step up enforcement action. We haven't seen that yet, except in a few cases. They have various enforcement mechanisms, as you know, letters saying to stop, seizure of equipment, other things that they can do. So it puts you in the position of anybody who's engaging in civil disobedience. You know, you should get a medal, and there's some risk.
Right. Okay, so now if you want to quickly run through those states where the licensing applications are opening up this week.
Okay, it is on our webpage, but I'll say it quickly. Alabama, Arizona, Arkansas, Florida, Guam, Iowa, Kentucky, Massachusetts, Montana, Nebraska, New Jersey, New Mexico, North Carolina, North Dakota, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Texas, U.S. Virgin Islands, Vermont, Washington, and West Virginia.
So people in those areas that may be listening, again, how can they contact the National Lawyers Guild's CDC?
I'm going to give a phone number too. The best way is our webpage, www.nlgcdc.org. Phone 415-522-9814. Again, phone 415-522-9814, or email to lpfm_info@nlg.org.
Peter Frank, any final thoughts?
Well, I'd say that this is part of a much larger media and democracy discussion. You just had a news bit about what's going on at Pacifica. But the public broadcasting world is very much involved in trying to make Pacifica a mainstream organization. The indie media centers, which you also talked about, are part of this movement. It's a larger part of a larger movement to restore or bring back some democracy to the country. And democracy in the media, you can't have democracy in the country without democracy in the media. So all these struggles are really important frontier struggles, as is yours to stay on the air.
Hear, hear. Well, Peter Frank, I want to thank you for joining me today. We got to run. We're out of time.
Okay, thanks for having me on, and good luck.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening. The Weekly Freak Show is produced live in the studios of Freak Radio, 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, and can also be heard on more than 15 non-commercial, micro-powered, community, and web-based radio stations, including San Francisco Liberation Radio, 93.7 FM. The interviews featured in this program are only a sample of the fine shows each week on Freak Radio. To hear it all, 24 hours a day, listen online at www.microradio.net/FRSC. That's www.microradio.net/FRSC. For questions and comments, send email to frsc@microradio.net. That's frsc@microradio.net. Or snail mail to P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. That's P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Or call us at area code 831-427-4523. That's 831-427-4523. Thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project for distribution. Our theme music was arranged and performed by Neil Norman and his Cosmic Orchestra. For everyone here at Freak Radio, my name's the V-Man, and that's a wrap.